reminder that we have exam scheduled next week on Wednesday. Okay, so in the adjoining room, evening exam, closed book, closed notes, as I had mentioned earlier. I sent out a sample exam and some solutions. Did everyone get them? Okay. So that should give you a good indication of what kinds of questions to expect. I haven't yet set the exam, so but it tends to be broadly similar to prior years in terms of scope and so on. Okay. Yes. Yeah, that I was going to just mention. So everything until last class is what is included. So what I'm going to teach today is not. Okay, it is going to be included in the final though. So today and on Tuesday, class is not to be just ignored. So on Tuesday, I will also spend a little bit of time trying to review material. Okay, just to see if there are any questions and so on. And we will have extra office hours. Okay, both the TA and I will be available. If you have questions when you review the material, you can come and talk to us before the exam. Okay, so I will announce those office hours, but I'll make sure that one of us is available on each day from Monday through Wednesday. Okay, for some period of time. You can always come at other times by sending email and making an appointment. Alright? Okay. So, quick recap, we started talking about fault tolerance last time, and I mentioned the sort of the various failure models that one encounters in this context. And our main interest here is fault tolerance in the context of distributed system, not fault tolerance in general. There are many fault tolerance techniques, both in the case of storage and computation, like RAID arrays and so on, that we will not talk about. What we are concerned here is you have a distributed application or set of distributed processes. Some of those processes fail. How can the rest of them continue to make progress? Okay, that's the basic question we are trying to understand here. So what I'm going to do today is introduce several techniques to implement fault tolerance. I'll introduce the notion of agreement in the presence of fault. We'll look at this problem in the abstract, okay, as a two-army problem and the Byzantine general's problem. I'll then talk about what implications these results have on practice, meaning when you actually design systems to handle faults, what does that mean? Okay? We'll talk a little about reliable communication. I'm not going to talk a whole lot here because some of this material was covered when we did RPCs. Okay? If you remember, I said I'm going to borrow material from chapter 7 at that point, and we already looked at that. Okay, so this will be dealt with very briefly, but I will talk about the problem of distributed commit and failure recovery in more detail. Okay, that's what is going to get covered today. Okay. So the basic, what's the problem of agreement in faulty system? So the picture to keep in mind is there are N processes. Okay, some number of them can fail. Okay, let's say K of them fail. And we want the system to continue to function even with this K failure. Okay, so this is referred to as a K fault tolerant system, meaning that it can simultaneously tolerate K faults. Typically, most systems will be engineered for K equals 1, meaning that one system fails. But the algorithms and the techniques that we'll talk about here are general, so they work even with the K greater than 1. Okay, now there are two types of failures that one needs to worry about. One is called crashes and the other one is Byzantine faults. Okay? So in what is referred to as crash fault tolerance, we assume that these K processes can fail silently. Okay? Meaning that whenever they are up and running, they are all operating correctly. Meaning any response that each process produces is assumed to be correct. But processes can fail by crashing, meaning that they go down and they stop responding. Okay? This is referred to as crash fault tolerance. Now, if you want crash fault tolerance and you want to tolerate K faults, that means you have to replicate that process K plus 1 times. Okay? Meaning you need K plus 1 redundancy to tolerate K faults in crash fault tolerance. This should be clear. And if K equals 1, what we are saying is you need 2 replicas so that if one fails, the other one functions. Okay? If you want to tolerate 2 faults, you need 3 replicas. So if 2 of them go down at the same time, the third one continues to function. Okay? So that's clear. Now, the other type of, so that's a simple enough technique to add redundancy to handle crash fault. The problem that we really are interested in is what is referred to as Byzantine faults. Okay, so in this model, processes can fail, but when they fail, they don't go down. Okay, they can continue to operate and they can produce erroneous, random or malicious responses. Okay, meaning that the process is going to continue to function, but it can produce garbage. Sometimes it can produce right results, sometimes it will produce incorrect results, and so the process behavior becomes unpredictable. Okay, so question is, how do you detect these kinds of faults and how do you tolerate these kinds of faults? Okay, so that's the problem we really want to understand. Okay, now this is clearly more difficult to deal with. Okay, you can't just add, so the crash fault tolerance technique doesn't work here. Okay, this should be clear. So if you wanted to tolerate one Byzantine fault, for example, okay, in crash fault tolerance, you would, to tolerate one fault, you need two replicas. Okay, you need one extra replica. That doesn't work in Byzantine fault tolerance. Okay, because what will happen here is both of these replicas will function and they will produce two different results for every request. Okay, you don't know which one is correct. Okay, because from the outside, you don't know which one is functioning correctly and which one is not. Okay, so you need more redundancy to detect which processes are faulty and then to understand which of the results are the right ones. Okay, that's the problem. Okay, problem of Byzantine fault tolerance. So to understand this, we will now look at some abstract representations of these problems. Okay, then try to understand, go back to real implications on systems. Okay, so the first one we are going to talk about is what's called the two army problem. Okay, now this is not, so the way to understand this is there are two processes, okay, and they are trying to communicate over an unreliable channel. Here we are not worried in this particular instantiation of the problem. We are not as worried about the processes being faulty, but we are looking at the channel itself being faulty. Okay? So channel is basically a network. Okay? So they are basically, these processes just send 1-bit messages. Okay? The message can be either 0 or 1. Okay? But since the channel is faulty, okay, and in this case it is Byzantine faulty, the channel can do arbitrary things to the message. So you send a 0. Sometimes 0 will appear at the other end. Okay, sometimes the channel will flip the message and show 1 shows up at the other end. Okay, so channel basically is assumed to be Byzantine faulty. So now question is, can these two processes send any 1-bit message and then agree that that message was received at the other end? Okay, so that's the basic question. So can you send a message over a Byzantine faulty unreliable channel and we guaranteed that the other end has actually received the message? Okay? So this is the basic problem, and the way to understand this is also what's called referred to as a two army problem. Okay, so here what happens is there are two armies that are waiting to attack. Okay, rather two armies as in two contingents of the same army waiting to attack an enemy. Okay, and these two armies are trying to coordinate with a messenger. Now it is assumed that the messenger has to go through some enemy territory in order for the messenger to deliver the message to the other contingent. Okay? And since the messenger is going through hostile territory, the messenger can be captured by the hostile army. Okay? And the message that was being delivered can be changed, okay, by the army. So question is, can the two generals of these two contingents, okay, reach agreement? Okay, the agreement may be what time to attack. Let's say they are just trying to coordinate and figure out what time to launch the attack. Okay, that's the message that is going back and forth. So can they reach agreement is the question. Okay, same problem as the previous one, saying can you send a message and be guaranteed that the other end has received the message. Then you agree that both parties received the message and the message is understood. Okay. Now the simple, so is the problem clear? If there is any questions about what the problem is. Okay, so you could say that you basically send the message and send back an acknowledgement saying I received the message. Okay, that's the first thing you would do. So if the messenger goes and delivers the message and an acknowledgement comes back, maybe that's the way to structure a solution to the problem. Okay, so let's see how what happens. So you'll have to understand exactly what is going on in this case. So here is, let's call first army A1 and A2. So a message goes there, okay, from A to B. For you have a question there? Okay. So now let's suppose an acknowledgement comes back. Okay. So does that mean that the two generals or these two armies have reached acknowledgement, because the first one knows that a message was received and the response has come back saying I received your message and I agree. Okay, does that mean you have reached agreement?
No, because the second one may not know whether the acknowledgement.
Yes. So when an acknowledgement comes back, all that we know is that the general here knows his message was received and successfully. Okay. But to reach agreement, the other general has to know that this one has actually got back the acknowledgement. But you don't know whether the acknowledgement was successfully received at the other end. Okay? So you could now continue this in round. You could send an ACK to the ACK. Okay? Now that ACK goes back, and maybe it was received successfully. Okay? Now this general knows that the acknowledgement was successfully received. But that doesn't still mean you have agreement, because this general doesn't know whether the act to the act was received. Okay. So you can continue this infinite times, but you are meaning that you can have any number of messages go back and forth, but you will never reach agreement. Okay. An agreement is a state where both you and the other party agree that the message was successfully received. Okay. And agreed upon.
You suggest the checksum to notify the other end whether we have
received. Question is, can you receive? Where is this? Oh, I think I have. Alright. Let's see. Okay. So, question is, can you use a checksum to figure this out? Okay. The assumption is that the channel is Byzantine quality. So, whatever you send may appear exactly the same at the other end, or the channel can do arbitrary things. The same is true here. You can have a message, but the message can be altered arbitrarily in transit or not at all. Okay. So checksum doesn't really help. Checksum is just telling you whether the message was changed or not, but that's not the problem. So problem of agreement is not the same as problem of reliable delivery. Okay. Problem of agreement is something more than the problem of reliable delivery. Not only that you send the message, but that both parties actually agree that the message was successfully received. Okay, so that's the key thing to keep in mind. So the property is two perfect processes can never reach agreement in presence of an unreliable channel. Or in other words, there is no solution to the two army problem. Okay, if the messenger has to go through hostile territory and you never know what message is going to reach the other end, or whether the message will reach the other end. Okay, is that clear? Yes, question.
It's easy to understand that the channel can be faulty and it can be Byzantine faulty. Right. But how could a process be Byzantine faulty? I mean, in terms of how could a process give responses which vary over time?
Question is, very good question. Question, how can processes be Byzantine faulty? There are good examples of why processes can be Byzantine faulty. There may be bugs in the process. Okay, intermittent bugs get triggered that produce incorrect responses, or even worse, your process may have gotten hacked by some malicious people and they could trigger arbitrary things in the process, causing the process to behave in arbitrary ways. Okay, so either security attacks or bugs are the two common cases of why there are Byzantine behaviors can be seen. Okay, you probably know that when some application you are running is buggy, it is doing arbitrary things. Right? You do something and it just gives some arbitrary. That's a big example of Byzantine behavior. Okay, but security attacks are even more relevant why you have Byzantine behavior. Okay, is this clear now that the two army problem really has no solution? So now we'll not worry about the network. Okay, so let's assume that the network is perfect, but that the processes have Byzantine faults. Okay, so the first problem was processes are perfect, but the network was Byzantine faulty. Now we will not worry about the network anymore. Let's assume that there is a way to get reliable messages back and forth. Okay? But the processes can be Byzantine faulty. So that brings us to the next variant of the problem called Byzantine generals problem. Okay? So here, again, it's the same problem, but now there are n generals, not two. Okay? And these n generals want to agree on something. Let's say they want to agree on the time to attack enemy. Now, some of these generals are known to be traitors, but you don't know which ones, who is the traitor. Okay, so there are some traitors among these generals. You don't know who they are. And because these are traitors, these generals can do arbitrary things. Okay, meaning that they may agree with you sometime, they may disagree, but you don't know how they are going to behave. And yet you want to reach agreement. And the agreement may be, let's figure out what time to attack. Okay. So now question is, can you reach agreement in this context? Okay, is this clear what the problem is? Okay. So it turns out that this variant of the problem does have a solution. So here we assume network is reliable. So whatever is sent from one is received at the other end. So that part is not the problem. Okay. The problem is to figure out who is faulty and to reach agreement in the presence of arbitrary behavior. Okay. So here are the four, we'll assume Byzantine general problem where n equals 4 and one we won't tolerate one fault. So we know, we'll assume that we know who the faulty process is or faulty general is, but these generals don't know that. Okay? They only know that someone is faulty, but we don't know who. Okay? So question is, can you exchange messages and figure out what the reach agreement, basically. So the process for reaching agreement works in rounds. Okay? In each round, you are going to broadcast a message to everyone else. Okay? If you are not a traitor, it's assumed that you send the same message to everyone. Okay, and your message is basically, this is the time I think we should attack or something like that. Okay? The faulty process can send arbitrary messages to arbitrary generals, meaning that it can send different messages to different generals or the same message and could do arbitrary things. We cannot predict what it is going to do. Okay? And yet we want to reach agreement. Okay? So just to understand what the message is, let's say that rather than actually constructing a message, we'll just assume that you just send your ID. Okay, so, but in reality, this could be a message saying what time to attack. But just to understand, each general is actually broadcasting a number that equals its ID. But this could be any arbitrary message. Doesn't matter. Just to make things simple is what we have said. So one basically sends a message that says one to everyone else. Okay, so here is the message that goes as one. And 2 sends 2 and 3 sends arbitrary things. So we'll just say it sends X to 1, Y to 2 and Z to 3 or Z to 4. Okay? And 4 sends 4. So at the end of first round, this is what everyone has received. 1 gets 1, 2, X and 4. So you send a message to yourself. So you get 1. So because you're sent also to yourself. 2 gets 1, 2, Y and 4. Okay? 3 gets 1, 2, 3, 4 because it's not going to lie to itself. Okay? And 4 gets 1, 2, Z and 4. Okay, so this is what you know you have received. Okay, in the next round, you are going to broadcast what you received from everyone else. So this whole message goes out. Okay, but again, 3 can lie. So 3 can construct arbitrary messages and send arbitrary things. Okay, so at the end of the second round, 1 gets 1, 2, Y and 4 from 2. Okay, it gets A, B, C, D from 3 because we just assume that this is an arbitrary message. We don't know what it actually is. And you get 1, 2, Z, 4 from 1, 4 from 4, and so on. Okay. Now, based on this, can we figure out who the faulty process is and reach agreement in two rounds just by analyzing this message? So what has happened is I know what I got in the first round, and I now know what everyone else received in the first round at the end of the second round. Okay, but someone is lying. So in this case, it's 3 lying, but I don't know that beforehand. But now looking at this, I know that basically because this column, so if I just look for a majority, I just know that 2 sent 2 because that's what comes back from the others. And then I know that 4 actually sent 4 because in the first round I got a 4. And then 2 also says that it got a 4. Okay, 3 can say arbitrary things, but since I know that 3 is lying. Because if 3 says it got something else, I know I got a 4 from 3. I got a 4 from 4, but 3 says something else. So I can now identify that 3 is the traitor because I have a majority here. Okay, so if for each of the column, 2 of the 3 responses match. So I can not only detect who is the faulty process, but I can eliminate its response from the picture and reach agreement. Okay, just by the majority. Is this clear? Okay, so to understand why this would not work, let's take a counter example and say when this wouldn't work. So in this case, we have n equals to 3, not 4. Okay, but same one process is faulty. So we eliminated 3 from the picture. So there are 3 generals, one of them is faulty. Okay, so same process, same algorithm can continue, and now we'll see why the you will not be able to identify who is faulty. Okay, so 1 basically gets 1, 2, and x. 2 gets 1, 2, y. And 3 gets 1, 2, and 3. Okay, and then this gets broadcast again. So at the end of the second round, you get 1, 2, y, and you get A, B, C. Okay, and then 2 gets 1, 2, x, and you get D, E, F. Okay, now this does not allow you to reach any agreement. Okay, because each, so you basically get two different responses. So you don't know which of these is this is correct. Okay, so to make this even simpler, so assume that you have two friends, okay, and you know that, and assume that you know one of them is going to lie, but you don't know which one is going to lie. So if you ask them a question, okay, and they give two different responses, you don't know which of them is to believe and which one to not believe. Okay, that's the basic problem. This, let's say one knows that it is not lying, but it knows that one of these two are lying. But no matter what it does, it basically gets different responses from these two. And it doesn't know which of them to believe. And there is no way for it to figure out. In the previous case, if you had three friends, okay, rather than two, and you know that one of them was liar, and you basically ask them a question, if two of them come back with the correct response and one of them lies, you can detect who lied. That's the reason you could figure it out the previous case, but you cannot figure it out here. So the basic property is that you need, with m faulty processes, your agreement is possible only if 2m plus 1 processes function correctly. Okay, in other words, you need 2/3 majority to figure this out. Okay, question, yes.
Is this sort of assuming that the faulty process is always faulty, because it could actually end up giving correct answers once in a while?
Yes, good point. So what if the faulty process gives the correct answer? Okay? So the problem is just to reach agreement. If it is behaving correctly and is giving the correct answer, there is no problem. Right? So that's all you care about. Only when it's not behaving correctly do you want to detect it and eliminate its response. So let me make that more concrete, okay, to understand this. So this was basically the abstract problem. To understand what one needs to do, so what you basically need is, let's say now you are designing an application, right? So you want to make sure that the application is Byzantine fault tolerant. So we will now look at, so these could be three replicas of the same application. Okay? So you ask this question about what happens when they behave. So what we will do is, let's say they are web servers, okay, for whatever reason. So every request is now broadcast to all of them. And you get back responses. Okay? So long as all three of them agree, you're done. Okay? So one of them could be Byzantine faulty, but if it is giving the right answer, we don't care, because for this request, all three agree that this should be the response. You know exactly one is for can be faulty. But if one of them gives an incorrect response, okay, then you basically know, you can detect which one it is, because the other two are going to produce the right response. Okay, so you basically can add a voting state that is going to figure out which of these are faulty, and you can detect it and eliminate that risk. Okay, so if one of them behaves in arbitrary ways at arbitrary points in time, the other two can override it. Okay, so now the important point being made here is detecting a faulty process is easier. Okay, so we just need 2k plus 1 to detect k faults. If k equals 1, that says you need 3 processes to detect one fault, which is exactly what we did here. Okay, if any one of these could be faulty, we need these three. You need 3 processes, and two of them will outvote the other one. Okay. Now, reaching agreement is a slightly different problem. Okay, and this is harder than just detecting which one is faulty. In the reaching agreement part, these three have to agree what the right response is and then produce it. Okay, so here we just assume that there was some external input and three outputs came out, and you used a voting stage to figure out which of the responses were correct. But if you say now the problem is as follows, where I just produce an input, each of them computes a response to this input, and the three of them have to first agree on what the right response is and then produce an output. Okay? This is harder. Okay? This actually requires one more entity. Okay? Because these three cannot agree, as we just said in the previous case. If any one of them knows that one of the others is faulty, it will not know what the right thing to do is. Okay? So you basically need, if you want agreement, you need one more entity, which is you need 3 click K plus 1. In that case, that was basically the voter that basically resolved the tie. Okay, so that was the fourth entity that entered the picture. So you could have replaced that fourth entity with just another replica, doesn't matter. Okay, is this clear what I just said? That there is a problem of detecting a faulty process and there's a problem of agreement. Okay, the agreement needs one more entity. Because even in the previous case, there was this entity in the picture. If these three had to figure out, okay, if one of them just became the voter, all of them send their responses, that doesn't work. Because that could be Byzantine fault already. Or rather Byzantine faulty, and it may produce an incorrect response. Is this clear or not? Some people are puzzled, yes.
Of them are going to send me a correct response at some point in time, but the Byzantine faulty one may send a correct response, may send an incorrect response.
Yes.
So it would be like I have to take this responses iteratively over a period of time. So how do you minimize that kind of threshold? Because it could be that the Byzantine faulty one is actually sending a correct response for quite some time.
Yeah. So question is, what happens? How many do you have to iterate and so on? Right. So when you add, so those were properties. I'm just showing how you would construct a real system here. Okay, so as I said, again, let me just repeat the example and maybe that will make it clear. So you want to create a Byzantine fault-tolerant web server. Okay, simple enough task. So you will put multiple replicas in there. And every request you will send to all the replicas. All replicas will process that request, produce a response. Okay, and then you want to figure out what's the right response to send out. So you ask, let's say you basically invoke a CGI script that will just provide some input, it produces some output. So all that you're doing is you're comparing the output and you're producing what the right response is from this output. So it's not this algorithm is not going to operate iteratively. You just produce an input, some output comes out, you figure out which of these is the correct output. So if they all agree, so there's a voter here. So if they all agree, if you say 2 plus 3, okay, that's the input, and they all say 5, the voter says all three of them are agreeing, so it will just output 5. Okay? If you say 2 plus 3, and this is Byzantine faulty, this produces 6 and these two produce 5, then it will say that this doesn't match, so here is a majority, so I'm going to output 5. That's how the system will work. Okay? Is this clear? Now, just to reiterate what I just said here, so if you just had these three processes, and so this I have labeled this as a voter, but this could be a logical voter. You may say that one of these three processes can themselves be the voter in this case. Okay? In that scenario, you will not be able to reach agreement. Okay? You may be able to detect fault, but you will not be able to reach agreement. Okay? So you do need this fourth entity to tally the votes and figure out what the right response is, which is why you need 3K plus 1 processes. So these are the three processes and this is the voter process in this case. Okay? If you just had three processes, this would not work because if this was a web server as well as a voter, for instance. Okay? So if all of them produced an output and they just sent this here, okay? If this was the Byzantine process itself, then it could produce an incorrect response to the voting in the voting process. Okay, it may actually take 6 and produce 6, although two of the processes have said 5. Okay, so if you had only 3, it doesn't work. Okay, the same thing that this example showed, that if you have 3, you cannot solve the problem. That's all I'm trying to say. If you have a real system and you only put 3 processes, you will not get the right response. Or you need a fourth process to take the output of the 3 and figure out what the right response is. Yes, question. Right. The fourth process, can it be Byzantine faulty? No, in reality it can be also Byzantine faulty. So the algorithm I showed is actually a simplified version. Okay. So what you would do is in reality, if you assume that anyone can be Byzantine faulty, everyone has to be a web server as well as a voter. Okay. So you broadcast everyone's response. So even in the voting stage, you need agreement. Okay. So there's a computation stage. We produce output, and then the voting stage also needs, you need to agree. Okay, which is why you need four. Any questions here? Is this clear?
How does one agree on the voting stage? Voting stage is actually results in agreement.
That's what this showed, right? You wanted to send a message, you wanted to figure out what the message is and reach agreement. This is the voting stage really, not the computation stage. So you want to agree, you want to figure out who's lying, and you want to eliminate it, and you want to produce an output. So here you have reached agreement. So that's what the voting stage would look. Okay, yes, question.
Can you once again repeat how one knows that tree is
in this case or in the second case? How one knows that tree is the,
because A could be equal to three, I mean tree could advertise the correct value to each one of them.
Yeah. So people are still not sure what happens when you behave correctly. So in Byzantine failures, okay, it's assumed that sometimes you will function correctly and sometimes you will not. So you only look at one request at a time. Okay. Not that, say, this is a faulty process, so I'm going to permanently banish it from voting. Because for every request, you're going to see what the response is. If all of them agree, even the Byzantine guy is saying the right thing, then you just let's say you reach agreement saying this is the right response. Okay. So the assumption is for some requests the Byzantine guy is going to produce incorrect response. So you only catch those requests and say for this request this guy is not producing the right response, I'm going to eliminate it. Okay. So you have to distinguish between a process being faulty or long periods of time versus what it's doing right now. So we are only trying to understand what is the right response to produce for a given request. So in this case, if the Byzantine guy agrees, so you don't worry about it. Okay. Is this clear? Okay. So I already talked about reaching agreement and so on. So there are other models which people have looked at where some nodes are Byzantine, some nodes are altruistic, meaning they are willing to help, and some nodes are rational, which means they function correctly. And in this case, they have tried to relax how many processes you need. So needless to say, given the high cost of Byzantine fault tolerance, that you need four processes to tolerate one fault, okay, this is not used in practice anywhere. You will not see anyone who says, I'm willing to pay four times the price of hardware and software just to ensure a Byzantine fault-tolerant application. People provision for crash fault tolerance, saying if node goes down, there's a fire in the building and the whole system just burns down, the data and the backup systems take over. That is done in practice, but there are a lot of results on Byzantine fault tolerance, but not used because of the high cost. This is something to keep in mind. So to relax the cost, people have assumed all sorts of things, like some nodes can be Byzantine and others are not. Okay, so for example, some nodes that are receiving requests from the outside can get hacked and can do arbitrary things, but other nodes could be behind firewalls or better protected. So in those cases, those parts of the application may be rational or working fine. And in those cases, you can relax the over, not relax, but lower the overall redundancy you need to add to get Byzantine fault tolerance. Okay. So I will not go into those results, but there are some papers that are there as additional reading if you're interested in those. Okay. Not part of the course. If you're interested of your Unicard, go and look at them. So now I'm going to talk briefly about this reliable one-on-one communication just to recap, but I will not go into the details. We already talked about this subsection of the chapter in lecture 3. Okay. So here is the problem of reliable one-to-one communication. So we talked about processes being faulty. Now we are worried about network doing arbitrary things. Okay. So the typical way people are handled this is through TCP. Okay, so you want reliable delivery. This is not Byzantine fault tolerance anymore. This is just problem of reliable delivery where the network can drop messages. Yeah, not that it is going to produce something else. So people use TCP when you do one-to-one communication. We talked about what happens in case of failures and RPCs. So we said, what do you do when the client is unable to locate the server? Requests can get lost, server crashes, replies can get lost, and so on. So he's talked about this notion of reincarnation and termination and orphan RPC computations and so on. So that was done in chapter 3. So do review that because it is valid in the context of fault tolerance also. Okay. So, but I will not go back to that topic. Instead, I'm going to talk about reliable one-to-many communication as opposed to one-to-one or RPC-like communication. So here, what happens is there's one sender, multiple receivers. And the sender sends one message out. This is multicast. And then it's assumed that some receivers receive the message and others do not receive the message. So now you want to make sure that all the receivers that haven't received it somehow get missing messages. Now in case of one-to-one, this is very easy. TCP has timeout. You wait for acknowledgement. If acknowledgement doesn't come out, you basically come back, you retransmit. So you could just extend this principle to this case where you send out a message and you wait for each of the receivers to send acknowledgements. Okay, so if there are four receivers here, as is shown in the picture, this is a sender, that's message 25, and there are these receivers. So you wait for acts. Okay, so if you get all four acts, you know everyone has received it, and then you're done. Okay, if some act doesn't come back, if one of them doesn't send an act, you can time out and retransmit. Okay, you could certainly do this. There's no problem with this. Because that's what is shown in this picture, that if everyone acts, but then one act doesn't get back, then you have to retransmit. So. Now, the problem with this is as the group size grows, you have what is called the ACK explosion problem. Okay? If there are 10,000 receivers, for every message, I have to wait for 10,000 acknowledgments. So the sender has to now process all of these acknowledgments. So there's a large burden on the sender as the size of the group keeps on increasing. Okay? So that's called the ACK explosion problem. So to get around this, what people have done is instead of sending acknowledgments, you send NACs. Okay? NACs are negative acknowledgments. So rather than saying, I received your message, you only speak up when you don't receive a message. Okay? So this is what is referred to here of a NAC. So first, you have to know that you did not receive a message. Okay, so if there's only one message being sent, you will never know that you did not receive it. Okay, so that clearly is not going to work. So assumption is there is a sequence of messages coming, and these messages have sequence number, they're numbered. Okay, so the picture here is that you received 23, okay, and then suddenly 25 shows up. Okay, so you know that you missed 24, okay, because there's a gap. So at that point, you can send a NAC saying, I did not receive 24. This is what is shown in this picture. So this is the receiver that missed the message, and it basically sends back a NAC saying, either you could have received it out of order, but let's assume for now that that's not the case. So that's a message that was just lost somewhere. Okay? So you send a NAC. In particular, what is being shown here is the NAC is not only sent back to the sender, but also to the peer receiver. Okay? Because if any one of them have it buffered, you can get that missing message. Okay. Now, in this case, it doesn't really matter if they are all on the LAN. There is no reason to send it to these other receivers. Just send it to the sender. It's just fine. But if you have a large group that is organized, let's say hierarchically, the picture that was shown there makes a lot of sense because you may have a very large multicast tree. Right, and so on. So if some leaf here hasn't received a message, you send a NAC, but that NAC is now sent to your peers as well as to your parent. Okay? So if you can resolve it locally, if that message is still buffered somewhere, the NAC doesn't have to trickle all the way back to the server. Okay? So you can just basically get a copy of that message somewhere. But if not, then it trickles up the tree until it goes back to the sender, and then you send it back. So this is basically what has been done in the multicast world. Now there are several issues here. Okay, one is since you're receiving negative acknowledgments as opposed to acknowledgments, the sender needs to figure out when it can discard messages. Okay. So So you have sent a message. Okay. You don't know how long to wait for negative acknowledgement before you can get rid of it, because if the network is arbitrarily slow. Okay, if you say I keep all messages for 5 minutes, then I discard them. Okay, so it may say if the network is very slow, your message may actually reach the out of order message, rather the message number 25 may reach after 5 minutes and 1 second, and the NAC comes back and you have discarded message 24, so you can't retransmit. So you have to worry about problems like this. In other words, you have to keep a large buffer, which is why a disk is shown here, not memory. Okay, so you can log messages to disk, and so there the disks are large, so you can keep messages for arbitrary amounts of time before you throw them away. Okay, so that problem is there. In case of TCP, you don't worry about this. Because you're getting acknowledgement, message is always in memory. And as soon as an acknowledgement comes, you're discarded because you know that the other party has received it. Okay? Any questions here? Is this clear? That's a good point. NAC does, if you have the last packet in your communication, NAC will never work there, because somebody that hasn't received the message will not receive any messages after this. Okay, so you can send a fake message called an ACK as the real last message and wait for something. Okay, so some such so workarounds can be used, but that is indeed a problem. Okay. So the next, so while on the topic of multicast, the next thing we are going to look at is what's called the notion of atomic multicast. Okay. So in the previous case, where we just looked at, so the previous thing is what's called reliable multicast. So here, you want to make sure that a message is reliably received by all the receivers. Okay. In the next case, this is a much stronger property that you want, which is called atomic multicast, which is a guarantee that all processes receive the message or none at all. Okay, so you want to atomically send a message and either everyone gets it or no one gets it. You don't want a scenario where a subset of them receive it. Okay. So what are the, where is this useful and why should we worry about it? So there is the notion, let's look at a replicated database example. Okay, so database is replicated. Did anyone go to systems lunch yesterday? Because this was the problem being talked about there. Okay, so database is replicated, and every query or every transaction in this case is assumed to be sent to all replicas. Okay, so you don't want scenarios where a transaction is executed now by two of the three replicas, but the third one did not even receive it. And then this transaction commits, and then these two have a state that is inconsistent with that state. So either want a transaction to be executed by all or none, because that's what, to preserve some transactional properties, that's what transactions say, that either you execute it and it commits successfully or it doesn't commit at all. So you don't want a scenario where two of the three replicas have now received it. Okay, so that is basically the problem. So now issue is, how do you handle this? So it turns out that the way this is really handled is to figure out who is currently in the group, okay, and to detect whenever some process crashes, to eliminate it from the group. Okay, the only problem arises when one of these crashes, not that, let's assume you are using TCP, so all the messages do get there. Okay, so we'll not worry about messages getting lost. But the problem will arise when some of these replicas crash, okay, and they don't really execute or receive the message fully. So how do you deal with that process? That problem is at the crux of atomic multicast. So in other words, the problem of ensuring that all processes receive the message or none at all just boils down to figuring out which process has crashed and to eliminate that from the group. Okay, and then to agree that the remaining, everyone in the remaining group has actually received the message. Because the process that has crashed is never going to, may never come up, so you just try to eliminate it. Okay, and there is a picture here that basically shows how this is done. Yeah, so you want to detect what are called group changes, which is when process, at what point processes crash, and try to handle that scenario. So I'll show this in two steps. First, I'm going to show what is exactly happening here. So here the group has four processes, P1, P2, P3, and P4. That's the size of the group. and the, here is the multicast. Okay, so every multicast message is now sent to everyone in the group. Okay, and this is assumed to be done reliably, and we know how to do that from the previous slide. So at this point in time, P3 is going to crash. Okay, so this message that was sent is now only received by P1 and P2, but not P3. Okay, this violates the property of atomic multicast. Right, because we said either a message has to be received by everyone or no one. So if P3 has suddenly gone down, any message that's multicast is now only received by a subset of the group. Okay? So to resolve this problem, what you need to figure out is that P3 has crashed. You need to first detect that. You need to just throw it out of the group and construct a new group. Okay? And then everyone agrees that P3 is no longer part of the group, so messages can continue to be delivered. Okay? So now you know that P3 is not part of the picture, so it's gone. So all the other messages are only processed by P1, P2, and P4. Okay? At some later point in time, P3 may come back. Okay? At this point, it may want to rejoin the group. To do this, it first has to catch up to where the other replicas are. Okay? For this, it has to receive all the updates since it went down. Okay? But because you are keeping track of exactly when P3 crashed and when you threw it out of the group, you know exactly all of the messages that came in that were not received by P3. Okay? So you can only send those messages to P3, have it catch up, and then it can rejoin the group. Okay? Is this clear? So same is true. So thinking about that database example. So if you detect for every transaction whether all of them have finished or not, at some point some process, one of these replicas crashes, and you throw it out of that the group, and the other two continue to process transaction, but you know when this one left the group. Okay. So when it rejoins, you know exactly the transactions that this faulty database replica has not processed. So you can send it those updates. So now it catches up with the rest, it rejoins the group, and then they all continue again, okay, and as part of a new group. So this is why problem of detecting failures is important, because you need to not only know who has crashed, when you detect that someone has crashed, you also know what messages that faulty process has missed when it went down. Okay, so it can then catch up later. Okay, now I'll show a very, so this doesn't tell you how to do it. It's just saying what the overall idea is. So here is the basic problem of how you go about doing this. Okay. So here, let's say there are these 8 processes. They are numbered from 0 through 7. Okay? And they are all processing these messages that have been multicast to everyone. At some point, let's say 7 goes down. Okay? Now, in this case, we'll assume that the multicast messages can not only come from the outside, but any one of them can also multicast a message to anyone else. Okay? So 7 has gone down. Okay, you know, you detect that 7 has gone down, so you send a what's called a view change message to everyone else saying process 7 is down. Okay, we need to eliminate it from the group. Okay. Now, when process 7 was going down, it may have been in the process of sending out a message. Okay. And in particular, that message that it was sending out may have been received by a subset of the group, but not everyone. Okay. To preserve the property of atomic multicast, you need to detect this condition, that there was a message that 7 was sending out, only some of the processes have received it, others have not received it. Okay, is this clear what I just said? That because you are want to guarantee atomic multicast, any message that is multicast, including a message that 7 was being multicast, has to have this atomic property, which is it is received by everyone or no one. Okay? If 7 crashed precisely at the time where it was multicasting a message, and it crashed in a way that message only got to some of these group members, but not everyone, you need to detect that and correct for it. Okay? And that is what this whole thing about virtual synchrony is. So you broadcast a view change message. At this point, you know that 7 has gone down. Everyone will have to now flush any message they received from 7 that was not acknowledged, okay, out to everyone else. So here is 6 sending out what are called unstable messages. So these are messages that 7 sent out. So if everyone does this, okay, then and if anyone in the group received a message that 7 sent, everyone else will also receive it. And then you will keep the property of atomic multicast that will be preserved in the system. Okay. Any questions here, what I just said? Is this clear? So you are doing two things. You are trying to detect when processes go down, and you are also trying to detect whether that process actually sent any message that not everyone else received while it crashed. Okay? Doing both of these things allows you to preserve the atomic multicast property. Yeah, the way you do this is you say 7 went down, and if anyone has received a message from 7, they just send it to everyone else. So that now the message that 7 sent, everyone else gets. Okay? Alright, so there's a table here on message ordering. Let me just skip that in the interest of time, because I do want to get to distributed commit. So we'll now generalize this problem of atomic multicast and make look at this notion of atomic commit. Okay. So this is just the atomic multicast property that we just looked at. It's an example of a more general problem where all processes in a group perform an operation or not at all. Okay. In atomic multicast, all processes in a group received the message or not at all. So the operation was receiving a message. But you can generalize this to say you want a property where all processes do something or nobody does it. Okay. Same example of transactions is true here. You send a transaction out to a replicated database. You want all of them to successfully execute the transaction, or no one should execute the transaction. Okay? That's your problem of what is called distributed commit. Okay, so now there's been a lot of work that has been done on this topic. And the most classic algorithm that people look at when you look at this problem is what's called two-phase commit. Okay, this was by Jim Gray, it's more than about 30 years old now, actually. Okay. So the problem of, as I said, problem of two-phase commit is to ensure when to agree that everyone has successfully finished the operation and actually committed. Okay, and you think of it in the context of a transaction. So the way this works is we'll again use voting to figure out whether everyone has done something or not, and figure out using voting whether to commit that transaction or not. Okay, so we'll use a coordinator process, and we'll use some other processes that participate in the voting. Okay. The voting itself is very simple. The coordinator basically sends out a message saying, "Did you finish this operation?" Okay. So everyone has to either say yes or no. If everyone says yes, then you know that everyone has finished the operation. So you send out a commit saying that it's fine, let's commit this operation. If you agree that everyone finished it. If any one of them says, no, I did not finish this operation successfully, then you abort, saying everyone should throw away the results of whatever you did, because we'll assume that the operation did not even occur in the first place. Okay? So that's what is shown in the picture here. So there's a voting phase where the coordinator asks everyone to vote. So you vote for a commit or an abort. A commit is if you think that it's a yes, you say commit. If your operation is a no, you send an abort. Okay? Everyone sends a commit. The coordinator is going to then send a message back saying it's actually fine to commit because everyone has voted commit. If anyone aborts, then the voting basically results in an abort of the transaction at all the processes. So here is the state machine of what this is, and this is actually interesting to analyze, and that's what we'll do. So this is the coordinator, okay, and that is in process. So everyone is initially in the init phase, okay. And when the coordinator sends out a voting request, okay, that's the vote request. You go into what's called a wait, goes into the wait state, waiting for the responses. If everyone says commit, everyone votes to commit, you send out a global commit and you go into commit. Okay? If anyone votes for an abort, you send out a message to everyone saying it's all that the transaction needs to be aborted because at least one process did not finish it successfully. Okay? This is the state machine at the coordinator. Okay? That's the state machine at individual processes. Okay? So here is an init state. Okay? Now, if you decide that you want to abort the transaction, okay, you can just go into the abort state. Because if you didn't finish it successfully, you know that no one else can commit. Okay, but if you actually vote to commit when you receive the request from the coordinator, you then go into the ready state, waiting for the results of the election to come back. Okay, so you have voted, and you wait for the results to come back. In this case, you voted to commit. Okay, if you voted to abort, then you just go to abort. Okay, there's nothing to wait because you know that you have veto power. Okay, so you vetoed it, so you just go to the abort state. But if you voted to commit, you have to wait to see what everyone else has voted. So you have to wait for the coordinator to come back to you. So you go into the ready state, and at some point the coordinator is going to respond. Okay? The coordinator responds with an abort, then you transition to the abort state. The coordinator says everyone voted commit and sends you a global commit, you go into the commit state. Okay, is this clear? Okay. So now the important property here that we want, because we are looking at fault tolerance, the important property here is the algorithm should always succeed no matter who fails and in what state you fail. Okay, you should never produce a result where some processes transition into commit state and some others are in abort state, because then you violated the property of distributed commit. Okay, so we have to analyze this to make sure it works. I just explained an algorithm. But now you have to assume that anyone can fail and in any of these states. Coordinator can fail in any state, the process can fail in any state. Okay. So I'm not going to analyze every possible combination, but I'm going to show an example of what happens when a process fails and it comes back up. Okay. So let's assume that there's a process, okay, that has failed at some point in this finite state machine, and it has come back up, and it needs to now know what happened to that transaction. Should it go into the commit state, or should it go into the abort state? Okay. Now the way it goes about doing this, okay, there is a lot of code here which we'll ignore, is it is going to contact, okay, some other process and figure out what the results of the voting were and try to figure out what to do based on that. That's the basic idea. If you crash, I'll ignore the code for now. If you crash and come back up, then you have to figure out what some other process has done, and you do the same thing. So let's suppose that you, when you came back up from your crash state, you are in the init state. Okay? And the claim is, if you are in the init state, it's fine to abort. Okay, no matter what anyone else has done. Because no one else will ever be in a commit state. Is this clear? Why? If you are a crash process and you come back up and you find yourself to be in the init state, the claim is that you don't have to contact anyone. Just go ahead and abort the transaction locally. And this is safe to do. You will never violate the distributed commit property. So what is true in the init state? When are you in the init state? Is the thing to think, and that tells you why it's safe to abort. So you are in the init state before the voting begins. If you have voted on something, then you'll either go here or here. Okay? Is this clear? That you are always in the init state before you have voted. So if you haven't voted, the coordinator is not going to make a decision, because it has to wait for everyone to respond. Okay? So if you haven't even voted and you are in the init state, you assume it's fine to abort because the coordinator is still waiting. Because it couldn't have made a decision without your vote. Everyone has to vote before get a decision. That's what the distributed commit property says. Either everyone does something or no one. Some subset cannot make a decision. Okay? So if you're in the init state, no need to contact anyone after you recover. Just make an abort and then tell the coordinator, my decision is to abort. Coordinator is still waiting for your response, so it will get the abort regardless of what everyone else has voted. The transaction will eventually get aborted. Okay? But now the problem is when you recover from a crash and you are in the ready state, that says that you voted for a commit. That's the only way you come to this state. You vote a commit and you come here. But you don't know what happened. Okay, so you have recovered from a crash. You know that you voted to commit this transaction, but you don't know what the coordinator did. Somebody else may have voted abort, and the coordinator may have aborted, or everyone else may have voted to commit, and the coordinator may have agreed to commit. Since you have voted, the election could have finished, even though you did not get the results of the election. Okay? So now you have to actually contact some other process to figure out what happened. So you contact some arbitrary process Q that's part of the group, and you ask, what was the result of this election? Okay? If that process says the results were to abort, then you make a decision to abort. Okay? That process says the decision was to commit, then you move into the commit state. Okay? So now what we have essentially shown is you can recover from a crash. And regardless of whether you are in the init or the ready state, you can always make a decision. Okay, and you can figure out what to do with the transaction. Okay, or have we? So what happens if you recover from a crash? You find that you are in a ready state. You ask Q. Q also says it's in ready. What would you do? You ask yet another process. Okay, that process may also tell you it's in ready state. Okay. So you could ask all the processes. They may all say they are in ready state. And then you just, then what would you do? So all this says is that if everyone is in ready, it means that there is no result of the election. In other words, the coordinator has crashed. That's the only way you can, everyone can be in ready state. Everyone has voted and they are in ready state. The coordinator has gone down. So in this case, you are going to block forever in particular. Because you don't know what happened. Everyone just says that they are in ready. Okay. So this is a problem with two-phase commit. If the coordinator crashes after everyone has sent their results, okay, if the coordinator crashes, then you don't know what to do. Okay, is this clear? In particular, I claim that if everyone else is in ready state, they cannot make a unilateral decision and say, let's abort the transaction. Why is that? Yes. Because the coordinator is just one of the processes. You just elected a leader. Coordinator is also part of that process. Okay? In particular, if the coordinator has crashed, it is also running the same state machine as a participant, and this is the state machine it is running as a coordinator. Okay? So if everyone voted commit and they are in ready state, the coordinator itself could have said agreed to commit and it may have gone into commit state and then crashed but hasn't sent out the election results. Okay, so coordinator comes back up, everyone else is abort, coordinator is also a participant, it's in commit. Okay, so you violate a distributed commit because one process has done something different from the other processes. Okay, so if a coordinator has crashed, you can never make a decision because coordinator is also part of the group. You will always be blocked. Okay. So if the coordinator, in particular, you can't just elect a new leader and start making decisions. Right. So this is a problem with distributed commit, two-phase distributed commit. That if coordinator goes down in the middle of an election, you will be blocked forever, meaning you will be deadlocked. You cannot make progress. If some process crashes, that's okay. You can, as we saw, that process can come back up, but others can make progress with the process crashing. Coordinator crashes are a problem. Okay? So I have 5 minutes. I'm going to. Because there's one more thing I did not mention here. When P contacts Q and if it finds Q to be in init state as opposed to either ready, commit, or abort, then also you can make a transition to abort because it shows that Q never even voted on the election. So it can, it'll go, it is going to abort and you can also abort. Okay, that's one more scenario. That's a very minor point. Okay. So two-phase commit can be generalized and you can add one more state here called new algorithm is called three-phase commit. This prevents blocking. Okay, so in particular, coordinator can crash, but this allows other processes to figure out what to do. Okay. So what happens here, the only difference in the state machine is everything else is same, but there is a new state called pre-commit that's added. Okay? So you can go from the ready state. If everyone votes commit, you don't say go ahead and commit, you say move to the pre-commit state. And when only everyone moves to pre-commit, you say now go ahead and commit. So commit is a two-step process. Everyone votes commit, and then you say get ready to commit, and you go into pre-commit. Then everyone says, okay, we are all in pre-commit, and you say go ahead and commit. Okay. And the claim is by adding just this one extra state, you can eliminate this problem that we just mentioned. Okay. In particular, if you get up, you come back from a crash and you find yourself to be in ready state, you can still make a decision. That's the claim. Why is that? first thing to note about this is from any state, you can only go to one of two final states, but never both. Okay, so let me just show you the previous picture. So from ready state here, you can go to one of two final states. Okay, but in the next state transition machine, pick any state. You can only go to either abort or commit, but not both. Okay, this prevents confusion, as we'll see in a moment. So now the point is, if you wake up in ready state, you contact another process. Okay, it is also in ready state. Maybe you contact all processes that are still up. Okay, they are all in ready state. You can go ahead and abort, which was not possible earlier. Okay, so you can say, let's all go ahead and abort. So this basically means coordinator has gone down. Okay, so but you can decide to abort, because the maximum that the coordinator could have done, because it is also participant, is that it, everyone has voted commit, so it could have gone to pre-commit state. It couldn't have gone to commit state. So if it wakes up later, the worst, if that's possible, it's here, not in commit. Okay, so it can still abort the transaction. It's not too late, because you haven't committed it yet. Okay, you can abort the transaction at any point before you commit. Okay, is this clear? Yes, question. Yes. No. So the confusion in the previous case was the coordinator actually heard from everyone, including himself. He decided to send a global commit, but he crashed. The global commit only went to himself, but no one else, and he crashed. So he went to commit, but everyone else is still in ready. So if they decide to do something, okay, they don't know what to do. Okay, the coordinator is also part of this, right? So in this case, in the same scenario, everyone voted commit. The maximum you could have done is you decide to go to pre-commit, and this message never goes out saying go to pre-commit. Okay? So everyone else is still stuck in ready.
So when do you go to pre-commit?
When everyone acknowledges that they actually received this pre-commit message. So now you know everyone has actually moved to pre-commit. And from pre-commit, there is only one destination. That's commit. Okay? So basically now you can reason about, if you wake up, you are a crash process and you wake up. If you are in pre-commit, you ask someone else what happened. If that someone else says we went to commit, you commit. Okay? If everyone is still stuck in pre-commit, you can still commit. Okay? Because you know the results of the election. If you are in pre-commit, you know that everyone voted to commit and the coordinator also agreed, because the coordinator asked you to move here. Okay? So you can always make a decision and move to some final state from this state. And as I said, if everyone is in ready, you can make a unilateral decision to go ahead and abort. Even the coordinator has crashed, because the worst that could have happened is coordinator has moved here. Okay? When it wakes up, it can still abort the transaction because it hasn't committed yet. Okay? That also shows that there is a line missing in the state transition diagram. Okay? Because if the coordinator comes back and it's in pre-commit, you may have to abort the transaction. Yeah, that the book doesn't have that in the trans, but that transition is still possible. Okay. Any questions here?
So for every transaction, I could be in a particular state of this finite state machine.
Yes, for every transaction. Okay, so let's say the transaction has started. Everyone is in init state. Okay, when the transaction, everyone has actually finished the transaction, they have to vote: should I commit or abort? That's the basic question. So you vote, and if everyone agrees to commit, then you all move to commit and actually commit the transaction locally. It's the same replicated database example. If anyone votes to abort, then everyone has to roll back the transaction. This is why you get this property of everyone does the whole set of operations or no one does it. Okay? So you encapsulate all those operations in a transaction and you do this. So you have to do this for every transaction as a result. Yes, question.
And if there's still a transition possible to abort, then how can you be sure to always commit when you...
So you can wake up from pre-commit, okay, and you can ask all the other processes what state they are in. Okay, if everyone else is in pre-commit, what does this tell you? That the coordinator has agreed to send the message. Or agreed that everyone has voted to commit, and so you can go ahead and commit. Now there may be some crash process, okay, That is in pre-commit. When it wakes up, it will ask everyone else what the decision is. Okay? At that point, if everyone says we are committed, it will move to commit. Okay? So your question is relevant only when that process is the coordinator and it wakes up and everyone else has made a decision even though it actually did not ask them to commit. So if they did make a decision, it will also go ahead and commit. Okay? But if they made the decision, they were actually ready. Okay? And they made a decision to abort, then you still have a chance to abort. That's all we are saying. Okay? So this needs a little bit of thinking to convince yourself that it works. Okay? First you have to convince yourself there's a problem with two-phase commit. Yeah, which I think is probably easier to understand, and then try to see how this resolves the problem. The book has actually a long description of this. It's not as complicated as it makes it out, but once you understand what's going on, it's very easy to reason. Yeah, but it's important to understand exactly how this gets around the problem, and that you cannot be blocked forever in this scenario. Okay, so we have basically run out of time, so I'm going to stop here. Okay. So next time, which is the day before the midterm, I will probably have a short class and then just see if anyone has questions about any of the lectures before today's lecture. Okay? Lectures 1 through 16 are going to be fair game for the test. Okay? This today's lecture is not included. Okay? So you can come back with questions on any question you have on 1 through 16. And we'll also have office hours, as I mentioned. If you have the project and you want to hand it in, do so. It's always fine to email it. Okay? And if you did not get your homework 3 or your project 1, I have them here. You can pick them up right now. Yes, question.
So, in the exam, I mean, like there's something in the book you did not cover.